actually practiced that song all week long for today, and I told Judd, I said, I can't get the right pitch. It's either way too high or way too low. And so I was thankful he was the song leader today because I knew he'd be willing to lead that. We're continuing through our studies. If you're following along in your readings, we read about Deborah this last week. Next week, we're going to read about these other guys. We're going to read about Gideon and Samson. And since Phil Sanders will be here next week, we're going to combine Gideon and Samson into one sermon. And so what we're going to talk about is men who are really, really strong, but not necessarily in their faith. And that's what we're going to talk about, because that's what we find when we look at those two men. They're faithful sometimes, and other times they're not. They're just like, as Judd would say, they're just like everybody else. They're men. They have their strong points, they have their weak points, and that's what we'll look at next week a little bit. Tonight in your home studies, if you look, we're looking at Romans 6 and part of Romans 7. I want you to focus on a couple of key words as you're doing this study with your family. The word into, the word submit, and the word present. You'll find those words throughout this particular text several times, and there's great meaning to what you'll see when you see those particular words. So as you're doing your study at home, I want you to look at those, and you'll find some lessons there that'll be really great part of the text there. Next week, Phil Sanders will be here. I'm so excited about that. I really am. I don't know if you're as excited as I am. I hope you are. He'll be here Sunday through Wednesday. He'll be here each night at 7 o'clock. We're going to have a potluck after Sunday morning services, and then we'll have our evening services at the regular time. We'll have our evening services at 7. The evening services will be at 7 each night. Monday through Wednesday, we got an opportunity for a fellowship meal, so you don't have an excuse. I got home late from work, and I didn't have time to feed the kids and still get to here on time, because we're going to have our meal at 6 o'clock. Come and eat and enjoy that. I know you will, and I look forward to that. Bring your friends. Here's a key. Bring your friends, invite your friends for Monday or Tuesday night. They may already have a place where they worship on Sunday. Invite them for Monday or Tuesday night and bring them on one of those nights and bring your friends with you. They're going to love it. We're going to love it, and we're going to all be fed well. The seventh book of our Bible, it bears the name Judges because it chronicles the leaders that God gave to his people to preserve them against the enemies in the promised land. It talks about how God had raised up judges for them periodically, and God will raise up judges, and we'll see this over and over and over again, that God will raise up judges for them. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. It's pretty evident as we read through Exodus 18 that Moses served as a judge for Israel. In fact, he had to appoint sub-judges underneath him. One of those was Joshua. We find that out in Numbers 11 and also in Numbers 24. The word judges can really be translated, and maybe if it was translated this way, we would understand it better, deliverers. Deliverers, because that's who they were. In fact, Joshua's name literally means the Lord will save, or the Lord will deliver. So he's a deliverer. Their judges are deliverers, and that's what they're there for. What we see as we read through the book of Judges is this heartbreaking story. It's a story of rebellion. It's a story of retribution. It's a story of repentance. It's a story of restoration. It's a story of reconciliation. Over and over and over again, they turned away from God. Over and over again, they rejected God. They rebelled against God. Over and over and over again, God sent retribution. He sent the Philistines. He sent the Canaanites. He sent different people at different times to come and to bring them back to himself. We call it discipline nowadays. When parents do that to bring their children back after their children have rebelled, we call that discipline. God disciplined them. Retribution. Repentance. They felt what they had done was wrong, but they did something about it. They turned back to God. And when they turned back to God, God sent a deliverer to restore them to himself. And they were restored, and they started over again with a fresh, clean slate, and they were reconciled to God. How wonderful that is. By the way, isn't that the story of most of our lives? We're following God until we're not. And then God causes something to happen in our lives so that we realize, hey, I'm in the wrong here. And so then we repent, and we're restored and reconciled to God. Until the next time when we rebel against God. You see, these stories that are here, the narratives that are here in Judges, are not just so we can know what happened 3,000 years ago. The stories here are so we can know that there's still hope for us when we fail today. And I think that's one of the greatest lessons we take from Judges, is that when we fail, there's still hope. And so we'll look at that as we look at this a little bit. Here's where I was going to sing the Judges song, but like I said, I can't pitch it right. I've tried it, and I I don't have that song. I've got a lot of them, but not that one. The judges of Israel are listed. If you look through here, you'll see there's 12 primary judges that are listed, but Eli and Samuel count, and then Samuel actually appointed two of his sons as judges later. So you have a couple of other judges in there as you look through the judges, and there's the chapters that you find the different judges in if you want to look up that. But for this lesson's purpose, we're going to focus down there on that fourth one, Deborah. And so that's what we're going to look at. That's who you've been reading about the last week. And so we're going to look at Deborah and see what we can find out here. There's four things that we're going to learn. One of the things we're going to learn is that leaders come in all shapes and sizes. They just do. Israelites needed good leaders. God doesn't show favoritism when he's picking leaders. It doesn't matter if you're right-handed or left-handed. In fact, we've got a left-handed judge who's very prominent as we look. It doesn't matter whether you're eloquent and you can wax the elephant when you're talking, or whether you're slow of speech, as Moses was. God can still use you. It doesn't matter if you're awkward or if you are absolutely a ballerina with your balance. God can still use you. The bottom line is that God demands leaders, and God wants leaders, and all of us are leaders. As a matter of fact, the Great Commission tells us each of us is to go out and to be a leader. As you're going through the world, teach the gospel to everybody you meet. Be a leader. Lead people to Jesus. That's what we're supposed to do. You know, when Barak thought that God was asking too much of him, he said, I'm not up for this task. Get somebody else. Sound like Moses? Sound like Joshua? Sound like you and me sometimes? Maybe get somebody else for this task. And so what happens is God allows a prophetess to take his place, and he doesn't get the glory. He doesn't get the honor that was due him because he didn't do the job he was supposed to do. As we look through the text today, we're going to see four things: Israel's character, Deborah's calling, Barak's contribution, and Jael's conquest. And if you'll notice, two of the three are ladies. Two of the three are women who led in so many ways. The first thing we see is Israel's character. You know, we see the defiance of Israel. Over and over again, the theme of Judges goes something like this. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Each one did what was right in his own eyes. The proverb writer says about that the ways of a man is pure in his own eyes, but the Lord weighs the spirit. The Lord weighs the heart. Oh, a lot of things we think look good. A lot of things we think are okay. But God knows our hearts. God knows the truth as we look at it. In Judges 4, verse 1, it starts out with these words: the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord after Ehud died. Wow. Othniel, Ehud, we're just at the second judge? And here we see him doing evil again after Ehud died. You know, you wonder sometimes when you read through here just how low they could go. You know, you just wonder. It makes no sense sometimes when we're reading this and we see this. They go back to doing evil in the sight of the Lord, and it repeats itself over and over again. The Lord sold them into the hand of Jabin, the king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. The commander of his army was Sisera, who lived in Harosheth Hagoyim. I said it real fast so that y'all don't notice I don't know how to say it either. We see their depression in verse 3. People of Israel cried out to the Lord for help. For he, talking about Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, had 900 chariots of iron. He oppressed the people of Israel cruelly for 20 years. Do you know we don't have any indication that the Israelites even had horsemen, let alone chariots? These are foot soldiers. Mainly because they live in a mountainous area, they don't really have a need for chariots where they're at. But there are these particular plains there, right by the river, and we're going to go to the river Kishon here in a minute in our story. But when they go to the river there at the Kishon River, there are plains there. The word, the Hebrew word, tar for plains, Megiddo, the plains of that are there. I don't know what, there we go. Megiddo. So we get Tar Megiddo, the plains of Megiddo, which is by the brook Kishon. Later on in the book of Revelation, we're going to hear that referred to again as Armageddon. Tar Megiddo, the great place of battle. When we read about the great battles that Israel fights when the enemy has chariots, they happen on these plains because that's a good place to fight. The two armies can line up, they can see each other, they can fight. There's not mountains in the way, there's not all kinds of ravines to have to cross. And it's a great place for horse soldiers. Unfortunately, Israel is not gifted with that. That's not their strength. They have foot soldiers. And so the battle is about to take place. They are able to cause Israel great consternation because of what they have. That's Israel's plight when we see that. You know, when they began to cry out to God, they didn't deserve his mercy. They had turned away from God. They had rebelled against God. They rebelled against God after the days of Joshua, and so God sent Othniel to deliver them. They had rebelled against God in the days of Ehud, so God had sent Ehud to deliver them. They had rebelled against God in the days of Shamgar, so God had sent Shamgar to deliver them. By the way, Shamgar and Deborah is about the same time. The best we can figure. They're about the same time. They're contemporaries here. What's happening is they're fighting in the south and they're fighting in the north. That's what happened in Israel. That sound like Israel today? They're fighting in the south. They're fighting in the north. It's an ongoing thing that's been going on since the days of that wild donkey of a man who was in opposition to his brother and has been all these years. It's not anything new as we look at that. During this time, as these people are in the midst of their depravity, they're following the same things the Canaanites did. They're sacrificing their children. They're worshiping idols. They're doing all the same evil that the Canaanites did because they didn't drive the Canaanites out. Deborah comes into a position of authority, and it starts off telling us a little bit about Deborah. When we start understanding her, I tried to find a picture of Deborah. I looked up the most famous Deborahs of all time, and I found some Debbies. I didn't find a famous Deborah. And when I looked it up on Google, the most famous Debbie of all time is Debbie Harry. She was Blondie, for those of you who are the right age to remember Blondie. The next most famous Deborah of all time, according to Google, is Deborah, the prophetess from the Bible. She's second. And the third one is Deborah Kerr, who I didn't find a picture of, but some of y'all will recognize Debbie Reynolds, and some of you will recognize Debbie Boone. She sang to me back when I was in high school. Something about me lighting up her life. I'm not sure. Maybe she was singing to somebody else, and I just took it that way. But when we're introduced to her, we're told that she's a prophetess. And we don't know much more about how she came to be in that position. She's not the only woman in the Bible who's referred to as a prophetess. As a matter of fact, in the New Testament, we're told Philip had four daughters who prophesied. So we know that it's not something, she's not the only prophetess. We know that Isaiah goes to the prophetess and she conceives a son and gives him the name that's the longest name in the Bible, Mahar Heshbon, and I forget however it goes from there, Mahar Elel or something like that. Gives him the longest name in the Bible. We know that. So we know there are female prophetesses, and we know that happens there. And she strategically places herself. She's married to Lapidot, but she strategically places herself between Ramah and Bethel. And because most of us don't have our Hebrew maps or our Israeli maps right here in the front of our head, I put one up here for you to see. If you'll notice, Bethel is really close to modern-day Jerusalem, very close. And Ramah is somewhere somewhat close to it as well. As a matter of fact, later on, the prophet is going to write of a particular city, Bethlehem, of Ephraim in Ramah. So we're talking about a really important part of the world where she was at. And that's where she put herself, between some trees in the hill country there. She sat under the palm tree of Deborah. I don't know, maybe it's because she sat under the palm tree, we call it that. When Judd did his story, his lessons on trees, he did a whole lesson on that tree, I think. And so we won't go any more into that tree. The people would come to her for judgment. You know what's cool? There are many sources that you can go to get information when you start studying. And if you Google, or if you Bing, or if you whatever search engine you use, you can find different sources. And I see people all the time use Wikipedia as a primary source when they're trying to talk about things. Here's something directly from Wikipedia. This is what Wikipedia says. Speaking of Ramah, the city is first mentioned in Joshua 18:25 near Gibeah of Benjamin. In the book of Judges, a Levite came traveling to Gibeah with Ramah just ahead. Judges 19:11-15. What chapter are we in? The city is first mentioned in Joshua chapter 18. It is mentioned in Joshua 18. We see it, and we see it, and we see it. By the way, according to Wikipedia, it's never mentioned in the book of Judges. Well, I guess Judges 19. That's the next mention. Totally skips over the story of Deborah when it mentions Ramah. I don't know why, but just something that I noticed when I was studying through my thing. We need to always check our sources when we're doing things. The next we see is Deborah gets this revelation from God. God says, I'm going to deliver the people. You call Barak, and tell him to go out and take a certain number of troops, 10,000. It's a particular number. Take 10,000 troops, and I want him to go out and fight this battle, and I'm going to deliver my people. And so it's so direct, it's so specific that the general should have been able to obey that. I mean, that's a pretty easy order to obey. But either he was weak, or he was afraid, or whatever it was, maybe his faith just wasn't very strong. You know, sometimes we think, the Lord is my strength and my shield. But apparently he hadn't read that verse yet. David hadn't written it yet. David hadn't used that verse yet, so he didn't have that to turn to. And so he wants assurance they're going to be victorious. He wants to know they're going to win the battle before he goes out there. He wants to know that he's going to come home. That's what he wants to know. He wants to know that if he takes into this war, he's going to come home. That's really what he's concerned about, it seems like, when we read about him. We hear about her reliability. She sees herself as the mother of Israel, a mother in Israel. You know what moms are really concerned with when their people are being oppressed? You know what moms are really concerned with when their people are doing well? You know what moms are really concerned with, period? The welfare of their children. That's first and foremost, that's what makes them a mom. I mean, the fact they gave birth, I guess that makes them a mother, but what makes them a mom is that they care about their children, the welfare of their children. That's their primary concern. That was her primary concern. So as we read about her, we see that. We understand that God has made this promise, and she wants to carry it out. And as we read the Song of Deborah, that's what it kind of looks like. But as we read the Song of Deborah in Judges 5, it's a celebration of victory over the Canaanites. And Deborah and Jael are going to play primary roles in this deliverance as we look at it. It highlights the bravery of certain tribes, the Song of Deborah does. It also points out some who didn't join the fight, and it praises God for the victory overall, and that's what we find out. As we continue reading, we learn about Deborah's respect. You know, Barak respected Deborah. If you'll go with me, I'll go. But if you don't go, I'm not going. I'm not going without you. The people respected Deborah. When they were called on to fight, many of them took up their swords because of Deborah. Because Deborah was going to go with them, they were willing to go. And so we see that they trusted her word. When she said, God said, they believed her. They trusted her word. They knew about her faithfulness to God. And the song clearly reveals she was brave and courageous. Susan Nelson, who wrote Women of Noble Character, says, Deborah is one of the most influential women in the Bible. Deborah's story in the Bible serves as an example of a woman who played a key leadership role during a crucial period in Israel's history and is remembered for her wisdom, prophetic insight, and courage in times of crisis. Wouldn't you like that to be written about you? Wouldn't you like people in the future to read about you and say, you were one of the most influential people in your community? Wouldn't you like people to read about you and say, you serve as an example of someone who played a key leadership role? Wouldn't you like people, your grandchildren and great-grandchildren, to think of you and remember you for your wisdom and your insight and your courage, even in times of trial? What a great woman this was. I think sometimes we get so caught up with all the men in the Bible, we forget. There are a lot of women who don't even have their names mentioned in the Bible. And yet this one has a couple of chapters here as we talk about her. We look at Barak's contribution. You know, Barak, or however you say his name, it may be any of those. They didn't have vowels in there when they were writing the names, and the oral tradition is all we have, and that depends on whether you're a Southern Jew or a Northern Jew, probably, is how you pronounce it. At least it would if you were a Southern Arkansasite, or an Arkansan, as we like to call ourselves, or whether you're a Yankee, as we call everybody else that lives north of Fort Smith. I don't know. The accent's different. The name may be different. But Barak is the way I've always heard his name said. But we can see his stress level. Judges 4, verses 8 through 10. He said, if you'll go with me, I'll go. But if you won't go with me, I will not go. She said, I'll surely go with you. Nevertheless, the road on which you're going will not lead to your glory, for the Lord will send Sisera into the hand of a woman. Deborah rose, went with Barak to Kadesh, and Barak called out Zebulun and Naphtali to Kadesh, and 10,000 went up at his heels, and Deborah went up with him. He's a general. He has no problem raising the army. He has no problem calling on these nations of people and saying, hey, come with me, we're going to fight this battle. He could have done what God wanted him to do without the help of Deborah, but he didn't. He didn't. That's what we see as we look at him and we see his stress level. You know, out of all the things to be famous for, would you like to be remembered as the one who said, oh, I'm not going to do it unless you go with me? He's not remembered for the battle. He's not remembered for being able to gather the army. He's not remembered for the great victory. He's not, he's remembered for saying, I ain't going to go unless you go with me. He's remembered in a negative way. By the way, isn't that exactly what she prophesied about him? Said, if that's what you want, you can have what you want. And that's going to be the result of it. You know, we wonder about that. In fact, you know, up until this time in history, biblical history, other than Miriam, you don't see many women presented in any kind of leadership roles in the Bible. Well, you see some really good women. You just don't see any of them in really leadership roles. And here now, and you see Deborah in this role of leadership. As we go through, we notice that after he gets Deborah involved, that Barak is able to get Ephraim and Benjamin and Zebulun and Issachar, Naphtali, all involved in helping him. But if you look, it also says that Reuben, why do you sit among the sheepfolds? Dan, why did you stay with the ships? Those two tribes didn't bother to show up. They didn't show up for the fight. That's what the scripture records. Some of the tribes were there and they were faithful. Some of the tribes were not there and they were not faithful. And you wonder about that. You know, when we look at it and we see this story here unfolding in front of us, we see that there's a lack of leadership throughout the people. And Barak is just the pinnacle of it because he's a general. But you know what you wonder? Where are the elders of the people? Where are the other generals of the armies? Where are the men who are supposed to be around to lead their families? Where are the Levites? Where's the high priest? They're not anywhere to be seen. They're not anywhere to be found. In fact, they're all absent. And Deborah has to lead the people. Oh, she can't do it herself. She has to get Barak to be the figurehead leader because he won't be the real leader. We can see a success as we read verses 12 through 16. When Sisera was told that Barak, the son of Abinoam, had gone up to Mount Tabor, Sisera called out all his chariots, 900 chariots of iron, all the men who were with him from Harosheth Hagoyim to the river Kishon. And Deborah said to Barak, up, for this is the day in which the Lord has given Sisera into your hand. Does not the Lord go out before you? You notice this? Deborah says, get up and go fight. Where's he at? I don't know, but he's not out in the front of his troops. Deborah says, get up and go fight. So Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him. The Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and all his army before Barak by the edge of the sword. And Sisera got down from his chariot and fled away on foot. And Barak pursued the chariots and the army to Harosheth Hagoyim, and all the army of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword. Not a man was left. Was he a good general? Yes, he was. Was he able to lead his troops in battle successfully? Yes, he was. Was he able to do all these things by himself? No, he was not. God fought the battle for him. God fought the battle for him. And that's what we see as we look at it. But there's some more questions as we look at that. I mean, here he is, seemingly maybe paralyzed with fear until Deborah tells him, get up and go do it. There's no longer a male leader for Israel's people. You know what's really odd? Where was Shamgar? When we read chapter 5, we find out that Shamgar and Jael are contemporaries in time. So Shamgar is apparently still alive during this because he's mentioned in the next chapter. So where was he at while they're fighting this battle? And the answer is he's fighting the Philistines in the south while they're dealing with the Canaanites in the north. He's there. He's just not available for this particular battle. Wouldn't they have liked to have had him come up to fight this battle? They didn't need him because God was fighting the battle for them. You know, as we look, we see the salvation that came. Chapter 5, it says, the kings came, they fought. They fought the kings of Canaan, Taanach by the waters of Megiddo. They got no spoils of silver. From the heaven, the stars fought. From their courses, they fought against Sisera. The torrent Kishon swept them away. The ancient torrent, the mighty, or the torrent Kishon, march on, my soul, with might. That's part of the Song of Deborah. They fought and they fought. God fought for them. What an amazing thing that was. The battle was fierce. The language paints a pretty clear picture. They're going to get 40 years of rest from their enemies because of what happens here. But you know what's going to happen after that? We're going to go back to that same thing of rebellion, retribution, and repentance, and restoration. The same thing over and over and over again. Jael's conquest. I love this part of the story. Sisera flees to feed his own sin, or to save his own skin. He's afraid. He gets out. He runs away on foot. He goes to a tent, and he gets to this tent, and he thinks everything's going to be hunky-dory there. He's going to be safe because he's got a deal made with the guy that lives there. And the guy's wife's there instead of the man. And she said, oh, come on in. Let me get you some milk. And she covers him up with a rug, and he said, if anybody shows up, you tell them I'm not here. So he turned aside, and she covered him up with a rug. And we read that, and we understand that, and we read it, and we say, hey, that's a pretty cool story that she does that. But remember, the Israelites are looking for him. And she's plotting. She's plotting because she knows that the Israelites are looking for him. So he's afraid. In verse 18, it says, he says to her, he says, you know, give me a little water to drink. And she gave him some milk. And he says, stand at the opening of the tent. If anybody comes by and asks if anybody's here, say no. He wants her to protect him. But that's not really her plan. You know, when you start looking up pictures of her and trying to find paintings of, if you look up the word Sisera and try to find a picture of him or any kind of image of him, all of them have him laying on the ground with a spike about to go through his head or already through his head. That's the way it happened. So the battle's over. So Barak is chasing after Sisera. So he's going to get vengeance on his enemy, right? And the next thing that happens is, when Barak comes in, she shows him Sisera's already dead. It's already done. I've heard people argue that chapter 5 says she drove the tent peg all the way through his head, or chapter 4 says he drove the tent peg all the way through his head into the ground. Chapter 5 says she crushed his skull with a hammer. I'm pretty sure she hit his head hard enough that the tent peg went through and crushed his skull. I'm pretty sure it all happened just exactly the way it says. It's just harder for us sometimes to understand. Once again, deliverance at the hand of a woman. And Barak gets no honor for it. But God has delivered his people. A couple of lessons we're going to learn from this as we look at this. Whenever God calls us to do something, he's going to enable us to do that work. When Jesus says, go into all the world and teach the gospel to everybody, he gives us the ability to do that. He gives us the authority to do that. What we also learn is that God used women to deliver Israel. You know, and even today, I can't name the number of congregations I've visited that the congregation wouldn't be in existence if it wasn't for great women who had stood up in their faith. We need that. We've always needed that. That's never been. Women have never been second class in God's book, ever been second class in God's book. In the church today, we still need strong leaders. We need men who are willing to step up, and we need ladies who are willing to say, hey, you know what? God means for you to do something great. We need women that will stand behind their men, and we need men that are willing to stand up because that was God's plan. He decided that men were going to be the leaders in the church. That's God's plan. You know why I think that is, among other things? This is just one little part of it. Can you imagine if powerful men had absolute authority over women, all women? Can you imagine how ugly that would be? That wasn't part of God's plan. God's plan was for godly men to lead. And the godly men that are leaders that God calls on have to have women right beside them. If a man desires the office of a bishop, he desires a good work. A bishop must be blameless, the husband of one wife. If a man desires to be a deacon, he's got to be the husband of one wife. Why? Because he needs the helper. He needs the support. He needs a Deborah. And ladies, there's your challenge to be the Deborah in your family, to be the mother of your family, to be the leader with your husband. When nobody else could bring peace, Deborah did. The church has to remain faithful to the biblical pattern of leadership. There's no doubt about that. But the biblical pattern of leadership, is when elders are able to do their job because they have the support they need to do their job. And that support comes from their wife. That's the biblical pattern of leadership when we look at it. God bless Deborah for all the things she did. He did bless her. She's recorded in our scriptures as a great mother in Israel.